The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, folks, we're going to start up again for our fourth panel of the day, which basically is designed to build on panels 1, 2, and 3, not to mention Professor Kirtley's keynote to start us off. We've learned about the nature of the Reporters Committee decision, including more that we did know until last weekend with respect to the inside view of the Supreme Court's decision-making process through Justice Marshall and Justice Blackmun's papers at the Library of Congress. And then we focused on the privacy side of the balance, practical obscurity, and then the public interest side of the balance, the government interest or the interest in showing government activity that was narrowed considerably in Reporters Committee. And now, building upon that, we're going to look forward. We're going to, we're going to first talk a little bit more about some of the ramifications of Reporters Committee that need some rectification in some people's view, and then throw it open toward the possibility that there will be, or could be, or should be, some remedial approach taken with respect to the FOIA, the privacy exemptions, and perhaps even with respect to the Privacy Act as well. It will be sort of a segue from what one of our speakers said at the end, which is, okay, now what are you going to do? I'll introduce just briefly, again, because we have the bios in your handouts. To my immediate right is John Croft. Actually, let me do it in the order in which they will speak. All the way to the right, which is certainly not ideologically so, is Professor Wendell Cochran.
I've been accused of that, too.
I cannot imagine by whom. Professor Wendell Cochran from Main Campus, as we call it here in the law school, he's been head of the journalism division at the School of Communication over there, and has been very actively involved in Freedom of Information Act matters. That's basically his area of academic research interest for quite some time, and is the type of academic researcher who looks very carefully at statistics, for example, with respect to the volume of use of Exemption 6 over the last 20 years. And then Professor Kirtley, who you met this morning, will be answering the call, I think, as to what might be done now at this point in light of Reporters Committee and in light of the implications and the ramifications, I guess I should say. And then we have a government representative, and you need to be kind to him. John Croft has been a government official for quite some time, young as he looks. He's at the Department of Homeland Security, where he's both the Deputy Chief Privacy Officer, Deputy to our luncheon speaker, and Senior Advisor for International Privacy Policy. Before he joined DHS a couple of years ago, a little bit more than a couple of years ago now, because I remember John was there before I retired a little bit more than 2 years ago. John spent 10 years in the Legal Advisor's Office of the State Department, and then spent 2 years as the country director for USAID in Turkmenistan, which John says is near Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and
Iran and Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, and just around the corner from Uzbekistan, right? There we go. John actually started his government career as an honors program attorney at the Justice Department, and he's here not to speak on behalf of the administration, that was his boss who was doing that luncheon speech, but to speak to privacy policy in general and to also look forward and to give us some balance on this panel as well. So with that by way of introduction, let me start off with Professor Cochran, and we'll talk a little bit more about some information that he has with respect to the ramifications or the application of Reporters Committee, and then we'll be looking forward as to what might happen in the future. There you go. You can either stay there or be a stand-up guy, either way, wherever you're comfortable.
I'll do it over here.
All right.
That way maybe I won't succumb to lunch and not off in some way. Often you find yourself sort of on the last panel and you realize that most of the things that you might have said have already been said, and often probably better than you intended to say them. So let me see if I can go a couple of different directions here. I guess I should take the pledge. I'm a journalist and not a lawyer, just so everybody is clear about my perspective. I'm also personally a libertarian, by which I mean that I think the government should know as little about me as possible. But as a journalist, I think I ought to be able to find out everything that that the government knows, okay, about everybody, because I believe in protecting. I do believe that actually I have a role in helping protect people's civil liberties by doing what I do best, which is find out information about, okay, what the government is up to, among other things. And so I also teach journalism ethics. I should correct Dan. I'm no longer the journalism division director. I'm just back to being a professor, and I'm sort of back to being an investigative reporter, which is really my roots, helping run our new investigative reporting workshop, where actually the luncheon speaker today, if I'd been really rude, we have outstanding FOIA requests that are clearly not being responded to, and it doesn't matter what the new policy is. We're still getting low two exemptions on things that clearly don't make any difference to whether it is closed.
Low two ought to be a dead letter now, and I can say that so firmly and authoritatively because I speak as the author of the foreseeable harm standard. Little did I know when I came up with it for Janet Reno that it was something that lasts not only 7 years, but perhaps another eight thereafter. And there's no doubt whatsoever that under the foreseeable harm standard for FOIA decision making, what we call low two is something that should never be invoked. Period.
Well, but it is. The reality is, and my guess is, it's not going to go away. We're actually supposed to talk about privacy here more than that. I'm actually reminded, every time I think about this, every time I teach privacy in my ethics class, I'm always reminded that there was when I worked at the Des Moines Register, the federal government had a new loan program for farmers in a drought disaster. And so doing what the Des Moines Register always did, we called the government and said, give us the names of people who got money through this program. And in 1978 or 79, whenever this was, they did. And so we said, let's publish everybody who got more than $100,000. Okay. So we did that one Sunday morning, and we started getting phone calls. You put my name in the paper, and I don't care about that, but my neighbor got $99,000. You didn't put his name in the paper. What about him? Okay, we'll go to $50,000. Well, you put my name in the paper, I got $50,000, but my neighbor got $49,900, didn't put his name in the paper. We ended up running every name of every person in the state of Iowa who got a nickel out of that program, not because we were trying to invade people's privacy, but because every time we tried to find some what we thought reasonable line, we didn't get complaints about you put my name in the paper, we got complaints you didn't put my neighbor's name in the paper. A sort of interesting view of privacy, and maybe those crazy people in Iowa and Minnesota just have a different view of the way the world ought to go, but that was what we found. And then we come forward to Reporters Committee, and I don't think these days you could actually do what we did. I know for a time you couldn't, and then for about 30 minutes you could, and then you couldn't anymore. It'll be interesting, the Obama administration trying once again to cut farm subsidies. And the question will be, of course, is, well, where do they cut it, and who ends up figuring out how to game the system? If you can't find that out, how do you explain it? I'm going to get to privacy in more ways in a second. So we come to Reporters Committee, which starts off, we reject respondents' cramped notion of personal privacy. That's the overriding statement in the opinion. Remember, I'm a reporter, not a lawyer, and that's my reading of it. And so instead of this cramped view, which is what they thought the Reporters Committee had and what they thought the law had, they come to this ludicrous decision that says personal privacy trumps everything. And that's where we have stood for 20 years, and everything the federal government has done for the last 20 years, and yes, I will say to those of you respectfully who are in the what I would call privacy lobby, they have fueled you in ways that you could never have been fueled previously, because they gave you the power of the Supreme Court saying, we won, we've got this. Right, so that's the circumstance. Dan said, and often I've talked about the ludicrous or the absurdities that I've found. Let me say, from my research, actually, over the last 10 years, privacy exemptions are cited 56% of the time. There are 56% of the exemptions used by the federal government. The year that it was most crazy was 2002, when it was 80%, thanks to Mr. Ashcroft and his decision or his position that the people that we put in jail or we detained or whatever we did with them after 9/11 we would protect their names for privacy purposes, right? So we had the disappeared in this country, and David Schultz just talked about another set of the disappeared, because you have a privacy interest. The Sixth Amendment says we're supposed to have public trials in this country, that the government's not supposed to spirit you away in the night and do whatever it will with you for as long as it wants to. But that's the position we've ended up in, partly as a result of Reporters Committee. So that's a little bit ludicrous as far as I'm concerned. 80% of denials or exemptions used in 2002, privacy was cited. The State Department still does about two-thirds of the exemptions that the State Department uses, which the State Department probably has less personal information about people than any other agency.
Probably not entirely true.
It would be hard for me to think of one that has more, where there's less. But leaving that aside,
Food and Drug Administration for one.
They got all those people that.
Right.
It's a low level, I would say, compared to many others. And I will say, in my numbers, I always exclude the VA and the Social Security Administration, because the volume of their requests swamps everything else and screws up the analysis. And they also grant about 99% of the requests that they get in full, because people asking for their own information. So my own absurdities, I think it's hard to choose. There was, in the Judicial Watch case, the Justice Department arguing that Osama bin Laden had privacy interests. At the same time, they were publishing his picture in every post office in the country as one of the 10 most wanted men in the world. A little bit absurd as far as I'm concerned. There was NIH arguing that a building's plans and the square footage of a building where they kept chimpanzees for research should be protected for privacy reasons. The privacy of the workers was somehow going to be harmed by releasing the size of the building. I found that a little bit crazy. With DHS, our program right now is actually asks for all the information about every person who's been detained by immigration authorities over a long period of time. The response we got was, tell us their names and get a privacy waiver from them and we'll give you the information. There are about 4 million, as I said. I found that a little bit hard to do, and if I knew who they were, I probably wouldn't need to know the other information. And, of course, that means I don't need it. And then my own ultimate absurdity is the notion that the federal government, arguing with privacy rights, as David Schultz just said, for people detained and abused or tortured or subject to harsh interrogation techniques, depending on what term of art you want to use, they have privacy rights at the same time that same government is operating an incredibly and unprecedented intrusive program of wiretapping and surveillance of American citizens. This is the government that's going to protect your privacy rights. Why do I have my own doubts about that? The public interest is not voyeurism. A primary purpose of government is, I think, the case of farm payments proves it, is equity. Similarly situated people ought to be treated similarly and have a similar outcome. That ought to be one of our bedrock principles of government, right? If I don't know who people are, Mark Rotenberg said this morning, the fact that a bunch of African-American, many African-American men disproportionately are arrested, doesn't say anything necessarily about the African-American men. It says a lot about our justice system. And if I don't know who they are, if I can't find out what their race is, how can I know whether they've been equitably treated? How can I know if the government efficiently operates if I can't get the names of contractors, if I don't know how much they're paid by hour, right? The kinds of things that I'm being told. Contracts, a whole different area in privacy. Often you get a contract that's redacted. The signature line, well, actually, no. The name of the contracting officer in the block is usually redacted, and then the person signs it and puts their telephone number under it, and that part is not redacted. It's the kind of stuff you see in these things all the time.
Well, I mean, they might do that in your case just to frustrate you, though.
They might.
Don't rule that out.
Which it gets to that equity. So let me come actually to the place that makes me not popular among my journalist colleagues. I argued and have written several years ago the notion that we as journalists, when it comes to dealing with privacy, with private information, that we should have a code of information practices as well. And here's, it's actually pretty similar to what the European Union put into place at about the time we passed our Privacy Act, actually, builds on that. That is, we should have some reason to investigate or to capture this private information. Anyone who's worked as a journalist, investigative journalist, knows that we typically quickly segregate out the people who we're really into, the cases that we're really interested in. I once got a million records from various states that many of them had Social Security numbers and dates of birth in. We didn't ask for those things, but that's what the government sent us. I think we should have segregated those out, and we should also do things like safeguard access. We should put passwords. We should limit the number of people who have access to these private databases. We should, if we're going to put them on the web particularly, we should update them because old information is incorrect information. And maintaining these databases is at least as important to us as obtaining them in the first place. And then if we're not going to do that, we should destroy them. And when I proposed that to everybody, actually at an IRE, an Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference, if they'd had rocks, they would have thrown them. Because they thought that I was trying to limit access to public information. And what I was actually thought I was trying to do was figure out a way, as someone said this morning, maybe it was Ari said, how can we balance these? How can we figure out what the balancing act is? Because rereading Reporters Committee, I'm reminded there is no balancing act, at least when it comes to Exemption 7C. Right? Six I'm not sure about, based on the opinion. If it's the same, then there is no balancing act whatsoever. In what realm of public policy is the concept of balancing act not in place? In what other realm of public policy do we not have balancing acts? Life is a balancing act, right? We all know that. Let me come back to that at Pat's point one time in this whole notion of practical obscurity. If you want to spend I'll get in trouble however I phrase this. If you want to spend some time poking around this evening on the web, go to a site called mugshots.tampabay.com. My friend and actually...
They're actually writing this down.
They should.
You should. Read it slowly. Pen's moving in that part
right.
of the room.
Mugshots, all one word, .tampabay.com.
Not to be confused with smoking gun.
It's actually a similar...
It's an offshoot of Smoking Gun?
it's a new and improved version of the idea of Smoking Gun. And because it's based in Florida, and anybody who works in the freedom of information world knows that there's Florida and there's the rest of the world, right? Florida is a completely... The Florida Constitution gives you a right basically to everything. So five sheriff's departments in the Tampa Bay area... post pictures and they post arrest information including things like name, weight, height, eye color, blah 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 blah, right, on the sheriff's department websites. What Mugshots does is automatically every hour go and scrape that information off those websites and put it on Mugshots' site, And puts a headline on, meet the 143 people who were arrested last night in the Tampa Bay area. Right? It went up about 4 weeks ago now. It gets millions of hits. Right? And so the notion of practical obscurity, well, the web automated that. Right? If you get arrested in Tampa Bay, your picture's going up on the website tomorrow. Right? No more scraping around and going through the local sheriff's offices to find the stuff. That's where it is. Now, do I actually think that it's a wonderful journalistic enterprise to do that? No, I don't. But they're making a little bit of money, which in the newspaper business these days is an important consideration. And they're revealing some questions that we as journalists and I think as the public need to take on. What's really interesting, just to take one more second on this, is one thing that you can't sort by is the charge information. That is, what is the person allegedly being charged for? And the reason they chose to not do that is they don't believe it's reliable enough because of what the sheriffs write down when they arrest you. Right? So there's that accuracy issue taken into account. The thing that the nod that they have made to privacy is they've constructed the site in such a way if you search for someone's name, it won't show up in Google. At least it won't be the first result in Google unless somebody searches for it a lot of times. And the other thing they do is after 60 days, regardless of the disposition of the case, whether it's been disposed of or not, they take it down. They rotate things off after 60 days. So that's a nod that they've made to the privacy, to the legacy concerns that people have. Let me stop there because I probably haven't said anything very important or interesting anyway, but let me stop there. Okay. Before I say even dumber things.
Okay. Well, thank you, Wendell. Jane, given those...
Dan, I'd really like to let John go next because they've already heard from me and I'd rather play
that. That sounds great. Okay. As a matter of fact, given what I know John will say, that could tie into that very, very well. So let's go to John.
Again, it might not.
Let's go to John second then.
Thank you and good afternoon. I'm not sure what John will say, so this is going to be very interesting for both of us, or all of us. First of all, I have a few strikes against me, I think. I'm a privacy hysterian. I think there was a term used earlier on the earlier panel about privacy hysteria, so count me as one of those privacy hysterians.
Not an historian.
Hysterian. I think it's with a Y, right? And the other strike is I'm a bureaucrat, but I mean that in the nicest way. I think bureaucrat can be used in a very positive way, and I like to think that. Three is I'm a recovering attorney, so please don't hold the attorney part against me. I'm also a little bit slightly anxious to be up here today because many years ago I stepped into a position at the State Department doing their FOIA and Privacy Act work. And basically the people that I turn to are mostly in this room, Mr. Metcalf, who is then figuratively but now literally one of the graybeards of FOIA with his partner, Dick Huff.
I'm afraid that I passed gray and went all the way to white.
Okay.
Alberto Gonzalez had something to do with that.
I take that in a positive way. And Maya Bernstein, who was then at OMB, who was very instrumental in manning all of the privacy advice that had to be given by OMB. So with that in mind, I hope you'll sort of bear with me. I feel a little bit like a student up here before former professors and teachers. In terms of giving you a little bit of the privacy perspective, we do both privacy and freedom of information in the DHS. It's called the Privacy Office, and it might help to tell you just a few seconds about that office. When DHS was created, Congress in its wisdom decided that this agency, probably more than any other agency on a day-to-day basis, would in some way kick, touch, feel, or interact with personal information. So with that recognition, they did create a, in the statute, it's a chief privacy officer. When the office was stood up with DHS, it was just one chief privacy officer and a secretary. We've now grown to 30 full-time federal employees plus about six contractors, and that split is roughly down the middle. About half of those work on Freedom of Information Act requests at a headquarters level, and the other half to the Privacy Act, which is also, it's quite a big lift for the office to do both. That's overseeing components. We have about 340, roughly, people in the components doing privacy for an agency of 210,000. So that's just to give you a little bit of grounding in terms of how we're working on both freedom of information and privacy. And I'd also like to offer maybe a little bit of a an international perspective on how I've heard a lot of criticism in terms of bureaucrats looking at Freedom of Information Act requests and evaluating privacy. Just to contrast it a little bit, in Europe they have independent data protection authorities, and by independent they really sit outside of the agencies, and they very, very rigorously enforce privacy in a way that I think would not be recognizable to many of you here. They often look down their noses at the U.S. as a place that doesn't do any privacy at all. And so I just want to kind of give you that perspective. That's not, of course, everyone. I'm doing a very gross generalization, but that's often often we're on the receiving end of that kind of criticism. So, and it's only recently that several countries there have implemented a freedom of information law. I think in the last 5 years it's been the UK, Germany, and the European Union, and if I'm not mistaken, I think Dan actually helped give some advice to get the UK's freedom of information function up and running, if I'm not mistaken.
2002, yes.
So, we're, again, just trying to give some perspective on where freedom of information and privacy sit and kind of a larger worldview. All that said, I mean, the topic here of the panel is really to look at the future of the Reporters Committee, and I do promise I'll talk a little bit about where I see maybe the future of at least privacy in a larger policy sense. I also just want to take a moment, just a second, and say that there is what I would consider to be a robust, networked oversight or accountability in doing privacy. It's not that, again, these bureaucrats are somehow out there just doing whatever it is that they feel like. As the Privacy and FOIA Office, we take that job extremely seriously, and as you saw from Mary Ellen's appearance today, I think it's a very positive sign that one of the early on appointments from the DHS, the new DHS administration, is the Chief Privacy Officer. That's a very good sign just a few weeks into the new administration. In addition to a Chief Privacy and FOIA Officer, you have an Inspector General. And an Inspector General will take a very hard look at how these FOIA requests are processed. And there have been some very critical reports that have come out, and in fact, I think there was one not long ago on one of the DHS components in terms of its Freedom of Information Act program. In addition, you have, of course, the Government Accountability Office, and that has itself taken a very hard look at how freedom of information and privacy is is implemented. And then finally, of course, Congress itself and the courts. So I really would like to sort of point out that we have this networked system of oversight that I think needs to be recognized, perhaps not to everyone's satisfaction, but it is out there, it does exist. In terms of the future of privacy, I think they're really kind of, for the Reporters Committee, I think there's almost two questions there that I'm going to say they're pretty high-level policy questions. I mean, what is the future of privacy, number one? And number two, in even a larger sense, what is the future of the government's management of information, of effectively managing this information so that the right information is disclosed to disclose what the government is up to, but the right information is still protected to protect those innocent people. And I think that eventually laws will catch up to both of these questions. But I would point out, I don't think the law moves fast enough always to reach modern day problems. We've had many advances in technology, as has been pointed out during the day in the last 20 years since Reporters Committee. So if the law isn't moving fast enough, might there be policies that can address some of these tougher questions? In our office, we do work to push out at least department-wide policies that try to take a very up-to-date approach to balancing the need for information disclosure and the need for privacy. I'll give you one example, though, of where Reporters Committee has been useful to us internationally, and then I think I'll probably try to wrap up here. But I want to go back to something I had mentioned earlier, which is that we're often criticized by our European colleagues for not having any privacy protections at all for the innocent European travelers who come into the United States. We get 1.5 million border crossings a day, 500 million a year. Many of those individuals are not U.S. persons that are protected by the Privacy Act. And one of the things that we can point to is that the Freedom of Information Act, Exemption 6, does protect any individual regardless of their status, and I'm talking now about innocent travelers. I'm talking about 99.99% of those innocent travelers that have their information collected as they go through ports of entry. And how is that information protected? Well, if you or I wanted to write in and ask about somebody that crossed the border and tried to get information out of a DHS system under Exemption 6, unless you would have a compelling reason, unless that particular individual was connected in some way to shedding light on the operations of government, in most of those cases, you wouldn't receive that information on the innocent traveler. So that's just one example of how often we rely on something like Exemption 6 in a privacy context for what DHS does. I will note that in terms of thinking about updating legal notions of privacy, there is a lot of activity, there's a lot of discussion going on among NGOs. I know Ari's group, CDT, is engaged in a public effort to update basic concepts of privacy in the Privacy Act, so people are thinking about it. I know I'm going beyond Reporters Committee now, but just to identify that I think Congress will be looking at potentially making updates in this very critical area of the Privacy Act. So I hope this has been valuable for you. I think I'm going to stop there and turn back to Dan and the panel and see who wants to go after me.
Okay, thank you, John. Yes, you can stand up again, yes.
I am.
In light of everything we've heard thus far, what next? What comes next?
Well, let me say that I really have appreciated the candor that we've had from John and from his boss earlier today, because it has fulfilled my worst expectations about the future of the Obama administration's plans on privacy and freedom of information. I've always believed that Republicans invoke privacy as a matter of opportunism and Democrats do it as a matter of conviction. And I think those who use it as a matter of conviction are infinitely more dangerous for those of us who seek access to government information, because I believe that they are absolutely sincere, although wrong in their analysis. I do not believe that the European model is one that is instructive or helpful. Some of us remember when this issue came up more than a decade ago, when the European Union's Data Protection Act was dangled upon us as something that we had to adopt because our patchwork approach to privacy was not in conformance with European standards. We didn't do that, in large part because the Clinton administration ultimately decided to punt it over to the Department of Commerce, of all places, to deal with self-regulation, to make that the way that would ensure the free flow of data between Europe and the United States. I would really hope that we're not going to look at European models now, and I'll briefly tell you why. As a justice of the Supreme Court once said, we fought a revolution to distance ourselves from European standards. There is much to teach us in Europe, but I do not believe that government accountability is one of those things. A lot of what goes on, I think, when we hear this idea that government has to protect information, which is a term, by the way, that I try very hard not to use, because along with others here, I believe that the government does not protect our information. It invades our privacy by gathering our information, and it damn well better protect it, except I don't think that its way of protecting it is keeping it secret. Secrecy leads to selective release, which is far more damaging than simply having open databases. I would also add that it seems to me that critical to this entire discussion is basically one point that I think the Freedom of Information Act, we would all agree, was intended to deal with, which is how much do you trust your government? Those of you who heard this morning heard me speak about the letter I got from my crazy correspondents in Louisiana, and I wanted to read you one other line from his letter. He said, "We trust that our military didn't put the terrorists in prison for the fun of it." Well, I'm glad he does. I don't. I don't trust the government an inch. And I believe that the Freedom of Information Act is the only tool I have to ensure that the government is kept accountable. And when it hides behind privacy, I think it is absolutely unconscionable. The other point that I would like to make, and I hope it's responsive to the question that you asked, which was, what do we do to deal with the abuses of the Freedom of Information Act? I can tell you what we don't do. What we don't do is close down access to information because we are afraid people will, quote unquote, misuse it, whether it's the way Pat Clausen thinks it's being misused, or whether it's the way you might think it's being misused, or whether, with all due respect, John, the way you think it might be misused. If we do not have the intestinal fortitude to say that we are sufficiently troubled by the use of information to either legislate against it or for a court to set up and enjoin its use, then frankly, it is none of the government's business what use is being made of that information. And to use the privacy tool as a way to basically control subsequent use of information seems to me to be an eminently cowardly act. I have no answers to all of these questions. I wish that I did. I'm constantly being asked, what's the future of the news business? I don't have the answer to that either. So maybe I don't have any business standing up here at this lectern to talk to you. But I do want to say that I think we have lost sight of some of these fundamental principles, and I really hope that, as Rebecca suggested earlier today, that we do not see in this new administration elevation of the right of privacy above the right of the public to know what its government is up to. I'm done.
Jane, let me throw something out to you.
thought you were going to throw me out, Dan.
No. We've got a sign at the other end of the building that says Defenestration RS. But it's not on this side of the building, not in the least. I'm only a moderator here. I'm probably not supposed to testify, but it just so happens I have some personal knowledge that can be brought to bear on this. I remember very well in 1993, the first year of the Clinton administration, and that year, by the way, seemed like about 19 years of any other administration because there was so much going on, things were so hectic with respect to health care and Vince Foster's suicide and just a myriad other things. At the time that Attorney General Reno focused on FOIA and issued her FOIA memorandum, at the same time that President Clinton issued one as well, and established the foreseeable harm standard, which just proves that skinny ties come back around again, because now we're back to the foreseeable harm standard, I know without any real uncertainty whatsoever, I mean really to a moral certainty, I know full well that because of Janet Reno's background in Florida, her parents were both journalists, and her brother was a business reporter for Long Island Newsday at the time. She literally had printer's ink, if not under her fingernails, perhaps even coursing through her blood. She would have been very, very receptive. This is 1993, 4.5 years after Reporters Committee, to a coalition of media groups coming in and saying, Ms. Reno, this Reporters Committee decision, it's really, it's like they say about the FAA data, it's for the birds? Yes. Okay. The airstrike, bird strike data. And we need to make a change. And people in my office, we were prepared for that. We were prepared to advise Janet Reno that this wasn't Florida. She was no longer in the Sunshine State from when she came, that we could not really change things as a matter of policy because this was the Supreme Court speaking, plus we have the prohibitive element of the Privacy Act for, as John phrases it, U.S. persons involved, but there would have to be a legislative change. Now, as it just so happened, it was right at about that time that the ramp up to the eFOIA 1996 amendments began. As a matter of fact, we were working very actively on those amendments, or what became those amendments, at exactly the same time. Now, it wound up taking until 1996, another, let's say, 2.5 years later. But I don't have much doubt that Attorney General Reno would have absolutely supported a legislative change in the 1996 amendments that would have been effective to reverse Reporters Committee. Now, you've heard today people make reference to the fact that something was done in 1996, and that's true. There was language inserted into the findings and purposes section of the bill, but that wasn't codified as positive law. In other words, it wasn't an amendment to the language of the statute itself. There was also accompanying that a strong statement from Senator Leahy, but it didn't even carry the full majority of the Senate Judiciary Committee at that time. It was one of those statement of additional views by him. And that's what the 11th Circuit in the O'Kane case and the Supreme Court implicitly in the Favish case decided was inadequate as a matter of law, as a matter of statutory construction, to effectuate that change. My point is, if that had been followed through on all the way to statutory change with Attorney General Reno's support, I don't think we'd be here today. So I'm remembering that. I'm hearkening back to the first year of Clinton. Now we're in the first year of Obama. And the question I have is there a case made at a conference like this? And is there the interest on the part of those who care about that issue to take that sort of step? And I'm not advocating that that's not my role. This is a role of academic discussion of it to serve as a forum, but I throw that out, I guess, for Jane first and foremost.
I don't know why you'd start with me, because I've never lobbied in my life. There are a lot of us in this room who could probably respond to that better than I could. truly, because when I was at the Reporters Committee, we didn't lobby. The Reporters Committee does lobby now, but I can't really speak to that. My work in those days was, you know, I'd provide testimony if I was invited to testify. So, you know, ask Rick, you know,
okay,
to ask some of this.
Well, that's another way of saying that the media groups back then who didn't push Janet Reno toward that end didn't include Jane because you were not in the business of doing that.
That's right.
To begin with.
That's right.
And certainly now in your academic role, I guess you're even all the more removed from that. So let me throw that out, I guess, to the audience at this point. Is there anyone who wants to express, or pardon me, I shouldn't do that. I should first ask our other panel members, anyone who has a view about that, whether you are a registered lobbyist or not.
Well,
that
actually
is the bottom line question, I think, that is posed by this conference.
Well, so actually let me divert for just 1 second, because Jane mentioned a couple times a day selective release and such. If I were a lobbyist, I'd apparently have no privacy protection by this administration because, well, we're not on the approved list. If you're a bonus taker, we'd be glad to put your name out as much as we could. Sex offenders, you know, we're close to the scarlet letter. If you give campaign contributions, your name and your address are required to be contained in federal records that are easily downloaded from the federal government. So I actually think personally, I'd probably not kick a sleeping dog at this point. I wouldn't give this Congress the opportunity to further restrict access to information. I think that's what would happen, regardless of what the President says in his policy. I think that's what this Congress would do, because I think the privacy lobby is almost it's like the NRA from a different perspective. It has that kind of, so they'll scare everybody to death. You won't be able to have a reasonable conversation. I would be very careful about what I did in trying to do that. It's bad enough now, but I promise you it could be worse. We could get a European style system.
Yeah, sure.
If I could just add a couple of comments, I guess, first of all, this is an interesting experience for me, because I'm usually at conferences where I'm being, not me personally, but the government is being criticized for providing no privacy at all. And so this is kind of refreshing, actually, to hear that there's privacy hysteria and too much privacy and privacy lobbies. So this is a good balancing experience.
No pun intended, right?
Right. Although, actually, if I could get a laugh, I would right now. The other thing is a small point. When I described the European system, I was in no way endorsing it, and I think somehow there's momentum there by the fact that I mentioned it. I was simply offering that as a contrast, and in fact, we've spent a lot of time from a U.S. perspective showing how the U.S. model does privacy differently, and we're not about to sign up to the European directive. So that's just two comments.
Speaking of privacy in a broader sense, I perhaps should also ask what people think the prospects are for not just a slight updating, but a more substantial overhaul of the Privacy Act as well, given that it's been in effect now since, September of 1975, which is a good long period of time. Anybody have a view on that on the panel?
I don't have a view other than, I can say that I know that there has been a lot of activity and a lot of discussion by some of the privacy advocacy groups, such as Ari's group, the CDT, to try to update certain provisions in the Privacy Act to bring them into modern day, to have them be harmonized more with modern day practices, because the Privacy Act, as Dan pointed out, I think it was enacted or passed December 31, 1974.
Yes.
And so it's showing some age.
Took effect in September 75. Yes.
Well, again, I don't lobby, and I never have, but my perception as someone watching on the sidelines has been, as I said before, that as a general rule, and general rules are always dangerous, but as a general rule, I think it's fair to say that Democratic administrations and Democratic Congresses are far more receptive to the privacy arguments than is the case with Republican administrations and Republican Congresses. So if the privacy lobby, however we define that, is eager to pursue this, this is probably, in that sense, a good time to do it. Whether it would be a priority on the legislative agenda, given the other things that Congress has to address, I think is a clear question. Absent some major, major privacy breach, and I don't know how we're going to define that because I think we've had incredible privacy invasions in the last 8 years, and in many ways, the general public, again, seems like my friend down in Louisiana. He doesn't really care. So if there is not constituent support for a change, I don't think it's going to happen. It's simply not something that Congress is going to put at the top of their list, especially considering that they just amended FOIA a couple of years ago.
Well, I have to admit or observe that given the pattern of legislative amendment for the FOIA, which is roughly every 10 years, quite a cycle like that, one would imagine, and I know full well from the pattern that's existed since 1981, actually 1979 when I first started getting involved in FOIA amendment, it takes years and years to build up to something, to ramp up, and then finally something happens. You have the 86 amendments, or the 96 amendments, or the 2007 amendments. So it would certainly take some time. I think it's fair to say once Congress started actively pursuing possible amendments to the Privacy Act before that would come to fruition. Let's throw it out to the audience. And I guess I'll use as the point of departure the strongest articulation, the clearest articulation of that, which is what Pat Clausen said on the last panel, which is, okay, given what we've heard about Reporters Committee, what now? Is there anyone who believes, as a bottom line conclusion to the panel, that some sort of change is warranted? And I guess when I say the word some sort of change, I mean by definition legislative change, because there really isn't much room for anything else. Anyone wish to speak to that at all? Yes, sir. Well, no, please come up to the microphone. That way we can be sure that it's carrying forward to the webcast folks.
I speak for myself, no organization, but my background is I was a private investigator for many years and part of the criminal defense for a witness. I was in college from the part of the investigation on my blog about the New York Times decision. And I testified in a number of interviews on the open records. We have portions from our industry.
But do you play one on television, sir?
No. But they represent the investigative and contract security issue. We're very concerned with record closure. We're concerned with the number of bills that the Senate Relations Committee has shepherded, or was prepared to shepherd recently. It will close up a lot of problems. Create problems for us.
Would those be problems of a pro-disclosure or an anti-disclosure nature?
This would be anti-disclosure.
All right.
But under the guise of, you know, personally identifiable information should not be out there. Putting a stronger clamp down on databases, credit data records, closing the dissemination of Social Security. I don't think that this is the time necessarily to take a shot at amending or going back and revisiting
do you share the concern that Professor Cochran has, which is the risk of be careful what you ask for because it could make it could be made worse? So to sum up, you'd have the concern that if you try to improve it, quote unquote, you'd be risking making it worse. Right. Okay. Pat, it doesn't sound like, and I'm going to understate the point considerably, of course, it doesn't sound like there's strong sentiment here responding to your call for legislative attention or doing something with respect to reporters' committee.
Well, actually, Bruce and I collaborate quite a bit on some of these issues, and I will tell you, I spend a lot of time personally on Capitol Hill, have for the last several years, lobbying on freedom of information and privacy issues on behalf of me, Pat Clausen, citizen, as opposed to any organization. I'll tell you what the picture is up on the Hill right now. You have a very broad bipartisan consensus in favor of pro-privacy legislation. And what is driving this, almost uniformly, is not any rational reason, but rather hysteria over identity theft and the constant media bombardment about identity theft. Hard facts about identity theft are not that difficult to come by that actually put the picture into some realistic numbers. The Justice Department has done a very extensive study on identity theft. They have found that the average loss to a consumer in an ID theft case is less than, I believe it's $1,900. And on average, the net loss to the consumer in most cases is nothing, because it turns out most so-called identity theft cases are actually credit card misuse cases.
It sounds like you're suggesting perhaps, and I don't mean to make light of it, don't misunderstand, that there ought to be more news stories on the subject of identity theft to educate the public. If only the journalists could get full access to the information necessary to write those stories.
Well, what's happening is I don't see journalists really going to any great lengths on most of these ID theft cases to present any real coherent, balanced view of what the problem is. What we have is a litany of hysteria stories about some old lady who had her credit card stolen and her credit card numbers ripped off, and all of a sudden she's got a massive bill. Well, the reality is in almost every one of those kinds of cases, the credit card companies eat those losses. And then by law, the only thing that the consumer is stuck with is for $50, and most credit card companies don't even charge that.
So it's like the insurance companies paying off the pirates, because it's part of the cost of doing business.
Exactly. All right? We don't have an accurate portrayal of what is going on with identity theft. There is at least one congressman up on the Hill who's overseeing some of these bills, whose wife was the victim of a credit card fraud scheme. Now, he is totally pro-privacy, totally lay down the handcuffs on availability of information because of what happened to his wife. That's a hard thing to get over. But the vast bulk of the congressmen I deal with, they're concerned about identity theft issues, and there's no rhyme, nor reason, nor rationality involved in this. It is a knee-jerk, emotional response, and it's got broad bipartisan support. Part of the problem we've had here is that the media has done a terrible, terrible job, and I say that as a former investigative reporter, terrible job of educating the public as to what the real facts of identity theft are. And too often the reporters are talking to the reporters. We have the group of journalists and media companies that have banded together for Freedom of Information Forum. That's wonderful. Where are the trial lawyers? Where are the collection attorneys? Where are the insurance companies? Where are the librarians? All right? Where are the private investigators? Where are the non-media stakeholders in this?
You mean a broader coalition?
Absolutely. And too often media people spend all of their time talking to other media people. And they just totally ignore any outside stakeholders that have a valid interest in this because, well, let's face it, they're just not as pure as we are because we're doing this in the public interest.
Well, let's assume just hypothetically that perhaps at the initiative of media groups themselves, people who are most directly concerned with and unhappy about the Reporters Committee decision and its consequences, that such a coalition were formed. What you're saying about the congressional perspective driven by the hysteria, John's word, regarding identity theft, would that make that legislative initiative a non-starter?
I don't think so. I don't think that there are any legislative initiatives that are non-starters. I think that what we have here is an education problem with a lot of lawmakers, all right, who have been fed a line of baloney on a lot of issues, and that line of baloney has kind of taken on a life of its own. That's hard to counter. But I've been in this town doing work here for almost 30 years, and I've seen very, very few issues in this town that couldn't be overcome with a good educational effort mounted by a well-organized lobbying effort behind it. We haven't had that, for the most part, in this area.
From a practical point of view, right now, my guess is if you went to the major media groups and said, you know what, we really need to take on this issue of Reporters Committee, they'd look at you like a rock fell on you. Most of them are so concerned with mere survival. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are actually bills in Congress being proposed to do things like, you know, give public money, create like an NPR, a CPB for newspapers, which is anathema to most people in the field. I mean, there are real issues. Reviving what was the old Newspaper Survival Act that created the joint operating agreements. Newspaper Preservation Act, excuse me, not survival. Preservation, Jane corrected me. There are other issues that really would take the fore, I think, and this one would slip back, which means you're back into, with all respect to the wonderful work that the Reporters Committee and Open Government, all these organizations are doing, they wouldn't have as much oomph as they could, because they probably can't get the attention right now of the industry folks. Meanwhile, you know, this bloody shirt of identity theft. I mean, okay, so this is not a nice thing to say, but the reality that the privacy folks probably need to understand, at least as far as we're concerned in the press, is you're way too boring for us. Most people's lives would never come under scrutiny by anybody in journalism. You know, you go about your ordinary life doing your ordinary things, and that's what happens, right? Nobody's interested in me as a person, right, as a journalist, because, well, I'm not a very interesting person from a journalistic point of view, right? You got nothing to fear from me, whether I'm going to come look whether or not you crossed the border 14 times last year. Unless in crossing the border 14 times you carried over 5,000 machine guns, now I'm kind of interested in you, right? But just crossing the border, what do I care how many times you did it and in what kind of car you drove and all that stuff? Even if it's in the database, I'm not going to write anything about that. I'm going to ignore that.
John? I was just going to mention, I agree with Pat. I think that the majority of the media stories have just really focused on this idea of identity theft. There are many, many aspects to privacy, but that's the one that seems to get all the press. Just sort of to give you an example of another one that it's gotten not much attention, but it was it came out, I think, at the beginning of the campaign season where I'm going to pick on State Department. I hate to, but I used to work there.
10 years there.
10 years there. where you had simply out of excessive curiosity, you had the State Department has one of the largest databases of all of federal government passport records, tens of millions of passport records and tens of millions of visa records. And you had some people out of curiosity just start looking at some of the presidential candidates' passport files. Senator Clinton, Senator McCain, now President Obama, and just for that excessive number of looks, there was an office director who was the subject of a criminal indictment and a deputy assistant secretary who lost their job, and nothing even happened with that information. So.
But that was a federal employee violating a federal law. Why that should apply to whether information is generally accessible it escapes me. There were rules already in place to protect that, and it didn't work. Right? What more rules can you build? You know, we'll shoot you at sunrise if we discover that you've done something like this.
I think Pat's going to do that with his 9mm. But by the way, I thought that was a really interesting blend of the First and the Second Amendment together.
The interstice between the two. Okay, let me try to sum up, and I'm going to give Professor Kirtley, Jane, the final word. You be the judge as to whether I sum up accurately or not. We've learned about this decision that started out with rap sheets, maybe a good example of, from the media perspective, bad facts make bad law. Certainly a very extreme fact pattern for consideration of privacy matters in general, given the broad range of information that the government has in relation to privacy exemptions. We've learned also that the Supreme Court really didn't focus hardly at all with respect to the narrowed public interest standard, that it just focused on categorical balancing. Could go one way, could go the other way, didn't really matter, just so long as it was done categorically to simplify the process. We've got a decision that has had ramifications for 20 years now. It's enough to make some people, I don't want to say froth at the mouth, but get quite excited, to be sure, about what the government has been doing to withhold information, especially perhaps now in a post 9/11 context, when since, what was it, the year 2002, Wendell, you said 80%?
Well, in 2002, 80%.
Yeah, first year after 9/11. And then the question is now, given that, and this is sort of unspoken, but I'll say it out loud, we now have a Democratic presidential administration. We have Congress held by one party, the Democratic Party, which is usually regarded as the pro-disclosure party in the FOIA sense, by a substantial margin in each case. And then the question is, if ever there were the time to go back and see if a change could be made, which would have to be a legislative change, now would be the time. But nevertheless, there's the concern from those who care about or have an adverse reaction to the decision, who bemoan the decision and have, what was the word that Rebecca used? She said something like, what would you say about Reporters Committee? That every day you wake up in the morning and the first thing, yeah, the first thing you do is you say, Reporters Committee lives, it's still applicable, or something like that. Yet, maybe this is just not the time, despite everything we've learned today, for the people who are of that sentiment to take any initiative in that direction. That's what seems to be the bottom line. Jane, can you disagree with that, critique that in any respect?
Certainly not.
Okay. Anyone want to have a last word here on the panel?
Yeah, I'll just say one thing.
There you go.
I have become convinced after 20 years of the Reporters Committee that really nobody in government believes in freedom of information. And I think that's the problem. Nobody runs for office or seeks a point of office on a secrecy ticket. But the fact is that once they get into power, their focus and perspective changes. And it may be for laudable reasons or it may be for venal reasons, but the bottom line, whether you're a judge, whether you're a justice on the Supreme Court, whether you're an executive branch bureaucrat, whether you're president of the United States, when push comes to shove, I just don't believe them when they say they believe in freedom of information. I would be delighted to be proven wrong with the current administration.
Well, on that semi-optimistic note,
I strongly disagree with that.
No, absolutely, John, because John is someone who's very dedicated to making information available to the public, to be sure, and was like that, I can testify firsthand, when John was the FOIA officer at the State Department as well, and the FOIA legal advisor, in the legal advisor's office. But I say semi-optimistic note, Jane, because you do leave room for things being better in this administration, as Mary Ellen Callahan from John's office was saying during lunch. So let's make it at least a semi-optimistic note that we end on. And I thank everyone here for your kind attention all day long. And I will see you at our next program, which will be CGS's third annual International Right to Know Day event, which is, of course, on International Right to Know Day, which is September 28th. See you all then.